Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
We previously produced two episodes in this series about Adolf Hitler. We wanted each part to be slightly different from your usual Hitler documentaries, which focus on his reasons for starting the Second World War, his rise to power, and his behaviours. We wanted to focus on slightly different areas of his character or life. Part 1 was about his lesser-known character traits and behaviours, and Part 2 was about his and the wider Third Reich's esoteric and occult beliefs. Well, in this third and final part of our Adolf Hitler trilogy, we are going to talk about Hitler from the perspective of his writings and world beliefs. In particular, his book, Mein Kampf, or My Struggle. Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler is seen as the most evil book in history, perhaps. Within it, Hitler describes his life story up until that point. He describes his plan to start a new world war, and his conviction that Germany needs to get rid of the Jews. He was not taken seriously, but when he came to power, he translated all that he wrote into practice.
The responsibility lies on the shoulders of one man. By his latest act of naked aggression, Hitler has committed a crime not only against Poland, but against the whole human race. Against the mothers and children leaving the cities of Britain under the great evacuation scheme with a smoothness and speed that avoids a single accident or delay. As they start out on what to them is the great adventure, already German troops, guns and planes have crossed the Polish border to kill and to destroy. So Britain prepares to fight, and never in our history have we been so united in the knowledge that our cause is just. We have no material interest in the quarrel between Germany and Poland, but we shall be fighting for something which is vital to our life and to the life of all civilized people. For in a world where the rights of the weak and the honor of the pledged word can be overruled by the high hand of military power, there is no tolerable life for nations or for peoples. So in spite of our hatred of war, we must meet force with force. And as our children move from the crowded cities to the kind care of newfound friends in safer places, what a tragic contrast to the preparations for the horrible struggle that may lie ahead.
In this episode, I will talk about what's inside of Mein Kampf. That's right, I read it so that you don't have to. And believe me when I say, reading Mein Kampf was my struggle. But anyway, to understand this book, you have to understand what's happening during Hitler's time. So I'm going to discuss with you the context of his ideas and what those ideas mean for the present day. Because whilst history never repeats itself, it certainly does rhyme and echo. It's the 1st of April 1924. Adolf Hitler is being escorted to his cell in Landsberg prison. He has been convicted for trying to overthrow the government. But he's lucky. Conservative judges went easy on this nationalistic troublemaker. They didn't exile him to his home country of Austria, for example. Or worse. He isn't even behind bars on a diet of bread and water like the other prisoners. In fact, Hitler is allowed to receive visitors. And with that, he gets so many food parcels from his admirers that he actually gains weight while in prison. But Hitler does have a problem. As the leader of the National Socialist Party of Germany, he got famous for his speeches. But in prison, he has no podium or platform to speak. He needs to show his followers the way forward. So, with that in mind, he decides to write a book that shows his, quote, Weltanschauung, German for his ideology. So, in respect of that, where better to start than at the beginning? Quote,
I consider it most fortunate today that destiny selected Braunau am Inn to be my birthplace. This little town lies on the border between two German states.
Hitler is born on the 20th of April, 1889, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in a small town on the border with Germany. But make no mistake, Hitler is Austrian, not German. But Hitler doesn't necessarily see things this way. Already in the first paragraph of Mein Kampf, Hitler uses his life story to promote his politics. Let's look at how that first sentence ends, for example.
This little town lies on the border between two German states, the union of which seems a task to which we should dedicate our lives and pursue with every possible means.
Hitler is talking about the political idea to unite Germany and Austria, both German-speaking countries. And as such, 13 years later, when Hitler's Nazi party comes to power, he will make this dream a reality. In March 1938, Germany will annex Austria. But the first passage of his book already shows us that Hitler's book is somewhat special. It's special in that he very clearly tells us what he is aiming to do. He makes no effort to hide the fact. From annexing Austria, thus creating a unified Austro-German state, to invading the Soviet Union, to its idea that Jews are parasites, corrupting German blood and must be removed from society, it's all in there. So, was there any question of where the world was heading in the late 1930s? Did other countries see where things were heading? And what else is inside his book? Well, as I stated, Mein Kampf means my struggle, or my fight. There are 12 chapters in the first section of the book, with the first part leaning heavily towards Hitler's life story up until that point. It's like a coming-of-age novel, but far more uninteresting. Hitler describes growing up, living in Vienna, moving to Munich, the First World War, and his move into politics. He writes it like a true hero's journey. It's filled with setbacks and moments of inspiration that led him to his vision for Germany and the wider world. But Hitler often lies and embellishes facts to fit his story. Mein Kampf is not factual or historically accurate. It's Hitler's version of how he wishes things could have gone. Hitler's daydream. But the readers don't know that. They take him at his word. Hitler never tells us, for instance, that just before the First World War, he fled to Munich because he didn't want to be drafted into the Austro-Hungarian army. For someone who is so obsessed with war, and someone so nationalistic and hell-bent on fighting for one's nation, well, this is not a good look for him. So he left all that stuff out. He also leaves out any mention of anything that makes him appear as lazy, bourgeois, or snobbish, which he also most certainly was. The second part of the book, with its 15 chapters, is more thematic. In it, Hitler describes different ideas for his party, the role of his ethnic states, his thoughts on communism, and what Germany's foreign policies should be. Hitler doesn't stick to his chapters, though. He will often go on long rants and tangents that sometimes last for pages and pages. His writing is riddled with emotion that he seems to have little control over, or an overblown perception of himself which doesn't allow him to leave out even the smallest detail which he considers as some kind of importance, no matter how small or trivial. So I will talk about the main themes that make up Hitler's worldview. For Hitler, struggle is the driving force of history. Quote,
"He who would live must fight, and he who doesn't wish to fight in this world of permanent struggle has no right to live."
Hitler believes that his worldview is based on science. Well, let's quickly look at this science. On the 15th of September 1835, a survey ship arrives at an island group close to Central America. The following day, a young biologist heads for one of the islands from the ship. After over a month of research, the biologist makes a discovery that will change the world forever. He finds the same species of bird on the islands of the archipelago. But on each island, the birds each have different beaks. This discovery leads the young biologist to a biological theory. That theory simplistically being that what if animals are not made by God? But what if they actually evolve over time? The young biologist is named Charles Darwin. Darwin's theory of evolution, as the biologist's scientific theory became known, describes how species must adapt to changing circumstances. But nature is a place of struggle for survival, and only the fittest organisms can survive. This theory makes huge headlines around the world, but it quickly gets turned and twisted. If nature is about constant struggle, why would human affairs be any different, for example? Thus, at least according to Hitler, humanity consisted of different races of human animals that were competing. The Aryan race was the most noble, and the Slavs and Jews were the lowest forms of life. Hitler took this list of race superiority from his own perspective and arrogant opinion, however. It was not based on anything else. Keeping these races from mixing was the only path to survival, Hitler thought. People do not perish from lost wars, he said. Quote,
but from the loss of the power of resistance that only pure blood possesses.
To survive, Germany needed to be a Volkisch Estat, an ethnic state based on a German race. But how do you keep this nation and its blood pure? Well, you could try and promote desirable traits. The goal was for the most beautiful bodies to find each other to bestow new beauty upon the nation. Hitler wasn't alone in this way of thinking. Many people were thinking it too. If evolution is a thing, why can't we help nature? Why can't we select humans with these desirable traits? In the United Kingdom, the Progressive Fabian Society wanted to breed humans like animals. Francis Galton, the British polymath and creator of the eugenics movement, stated, quote,
if a 20th part of the cost and pains were spent in measures for the improvement of the human race that is spent on the improvement of the breed of horses and cattle, what a galaxy of genius we might not create.
For those of you interested in eugenics, I'm dropping an episode about the new rise of eugenics exclusively for Patreon members later today. To listen to that additional episode, you just need to head over to patreon.com/deadsouls and subscribe to our club. It's just $2. So honestly, the best deal that you are going to get all day. Anyway, you might be tempted to say, what's so bad about that? Making sure that the most healthy people make babies? Maybe we can eradicate diseases too. The issue is, it doesn't stop just there. Because Hitler saw a nation that was infected and diseased by racial mixing. This, Hitler felt, needed fixing. Quote,
in our present state of law and order, this brave bourgeois national world looks upon it as a crime to make procreation impossible for those who suffer with syphilis, tuberculosis, hereditary diseases, and also cripples and cretins.
It went even further. Quote,
if in Germany in a year 1 million children would be born and we would take 700,000 to 800,000 away, the people might be stronger in the end.
But Hitler was not alone on this direction of thinking at the time. Winston Churchill, for example, wanted to sterilize risk groups, and some respected thinkers of the time believed that humanity should not waste time caring for the defective. Instead, so-called lethal chambers would be a better investment of time and finances. When the Nazis came to power, they took the idea of these so-called lethal chambers entirely seriously. After 1933, they sterilized 400,000 people. They killed 70,000 disabled and mental patients, and murdered 5,000 children. Hitler spent a lot of time thinking about the First World War. He has many positive memories.
For me, as for every German, the most memorable period of my life now began. Like so many others, I had one worry during these days, that we might not reach the front in time.
During the First World War, Hitler felt, for the first time in his life, a kind of belonging, a purpose. Sure, he got injured twice, but he received the Iron Cross for bravery, and it forever defined his worldview. He wouldn't be the only one who came out of this war forever changed, but he would be the only one who came into power. The war also helped him in ways that he could never have imagined. There's a quote by Karl Marx. I can't recall it exactly, but to paraphrase, it states,
"Men make their own history, but under circumstances that they don't choose."
Well, Hitler found himself in circumstances that have been described as a perfect storm for him. At the end of the First World War, a revolution overthrew the German Emperor and established a democratic republic. And when Hitler decides to venture into politics, Germany is in really bad shape. You see, the First World War was a war on a scale that the world had never seen before. 1.8 million Germans died. 2.7 million were permanently disfigured. Millions of men that had gotten used to daily violence were then discharged from the army. They returned to civilian society as soldiers that had lost a war. They returned as losers in search for meaning. Many men, due to these factors, turned to extremes. For example, to the Communist Party and to right-wing nationalistic Freikorps. Freikorps were paramilitary organizations that formed in the aftermath of the First World War, where the men involved formed civilian units which consisted primarily of demobilized soldiers, young men and conservative nationalists blaming socialists and communists for Germany's problems, sort of like cosplaying still being in the army. Many of them believed in conspiracy theories. They think the German army was not defeated on the battlefield at all, for example. They think treacherous socialists, liberals and Jews had organized strikes and sabotaged the home front. Freikorps members also fiercely believed in an apocalyptic narrative that cast international communism as a plot orchestrated by Jewish elites to destroy traditional German society and Christian civilization. This became known as the Deutsches Siegländer, or the stab in the back myth. It certainly didn't matter that reality was so different to this fable, that after 4 years Germany was on its knees, that the generals knew that with America entering the war they were never going to win. They could ignore all of those facts for the elements which they wanted to believe. It's easy to blame the Jews. It had been the case for hundreds of years. It must be true. Besides, the Jews won't push back, right? When Hitler starts giving speeches, he often talks to veterans like those in the Freikorps. And like any good influencer, he knows extremism is good for engagement. He leans into this kind of conspiracy and myth. He lies to his listeners. He tells them what they want to hear and believe. He denounces the socialist leaders of Germany. This kind of talk quickly leads to political violence. Thus, between 1919 and 1923, a wave of political assassinations rips through the country. In just a 4-year period, Germany sees 376 political murders, of which 354 were committed by right-wing nationalist assassins. They even assassinate serving government ministers. Now, in addition to the stab in the back myth, there is another theme that Hitler can always rely on to really get his audience going. In his book, Hitler doesn't stop talking about the treaty that ended the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles.
A precondition for future success of our movement was that it should impart knowledge of the peace treaty to the broadest masses.
Germany lost a lot of territory due to the treaty. They also had to pay huge war reparations and reduce their army to just 100,000 serving soldiers. But the worst part of it was Article 231. This stated that Germany was the only country responsible for the war. It wasn't, but history is written by the victorious, remember? In Mein Kampf, Hitler presents both he and the Nazi Party as the only people opposing this treaty or settlement. It's not true, of course, but it's a careful strategy.
We have to engrave ourselves into men's minds as an enemy of the treaty. A recollection of our earlier position would earn us the people's confidence.
Then, when the German government couldn't pay their reparations bill in January of 1923, France and Belgium occupied the Ruhrgebiet, the industrial heartland of Germany, in response. Hitler knows he has rhetoric gold in his hands. He gets ready for a speech. It's the first time that the New York Times will cover a performance of this new man on the scene, so to speak. The American media correspondent sits between an aristocratic general from the First World War and a communist sympathizer while listening to Hitler. To quote the New York Times reporter,
"Suddenly everyone jumps up and a roar of applause sweeps through the big hall. Upon the speaker's platform steps a simple, modest-looking, slender man of a medium height who seems underfed and overworked. In astonishment, I note that the condescending look of the old general on my left is gradually making way for an expression of rapt attention. My neighbor on the right, the communist, no longer merely claps his hands in applause. In his eyes, I think I see tears, and at every slight pause in the speaker's address, he roars approval with all his might. In fact, in spite of the speaker's moderate tone, a very hurricane of elemental passion seems to be sweeping down upon the audience."
Now, this was at the start of 1923. The situation with the killings, the coups, the violence on the streets is already bad, but it's about to get a lot worse. On the 1st of January, you would need 70,000 German marks to get $1. But this quickly changes. By December the 1st, you need 4 trillion, 200 billion German marks to get $1. The money prices couldn't keep up. Hyperinflation tears through Germany. People ran around with wheelbarrows full of cash to spend it as quickly as possible. Shops were constantly updating their prices. Bread could be twice as expensive in just 1 hour. And thus, all of people's savings are being wiped out in just a single day. Their salaries become worthless. Looting, chaos, the shame that you would have to send your children to school in clothes that are made from curtains. Society was falling apart. The historian Sebastian Hoffner said that the year 1923 prepared Germany not specifically for National Socialism, but for every fantastic adventure ahead. At the start of 1923, Hitler's Nazi Party had 6,000 members. By the end of the year, they had more than 55,000. This wouldn't have been possible without Hitler's grasp of mass psychology. Hitler had a big talent for propaganda. He didn't think too much about the general mass of people. He wrote, quote,
"The receptive powers of the masses are very restricted and their understanding is flat. Such being the case, all effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed in stereotype formulas. These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forth."
Hitler also understands that every great story needed an opponent. A mirror image of the hero, a so-called villain. The thing was, there are so many things that he didn't like. Socialists, communists, the Jews, modern consumer culture, the sexualization of society. But having too many opponents, well, that will be too difficult for the masses to digest. Quote,
their sense of objectivity will be aroused. They will ask how it is possible that all the others can be so wrong and that me and my movement alone are right. Hence, it will always be necessary to group all opponents together into forming one solid front so that the mass of followers will see only one common enemy against them whom they have to fight.
So, the enemy Hitler gives to the audience is like a recipe with all the ingredients he loves to hate. It's like pizza with ice cream. A combination of socialist, communist, and Jews that is responsible for everything that goes wrong in society. So, when he says during his first trial that, quote,
the future of Germany is called the destruction of Marxism. Either it's racial poison that mass tuberculosis will spread over our people, and then Germany will die from its sick lung, or this will be moved, and then Germany can flourish again, but not before.
Hitler's message is clear. For all of his hatred, Hitler does admire the organization of the socialists. He consciously copies them. He steals their mass gatherings, their use of banners. He uses their color. Then, from the communists, he understands that he needs a good logo. Quote,
the new flag has to be equally a symbol of our own struggle. It is expected also to be highly effective as a poster. An effective insignia can, in hundreds of thousands of cases, give the first impetus towards interest in a movement.
When Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote their Communist Manifesto in 1848, the rise of a communist state was just theory. But in 1917, Tsarist Russia fell to a communist revolution, and this sent shockwaves through Europe. Many people in Germany feared that the revolution would soon reach their doors. Hitler hates anything that has to do with socialism, communism, and Marxism. All of them believe in solidarity among the working class, a solidarity that crosses borders of countries. And for Hitler, who is an extreme nationalist, that poses a problem. International solidarity will not work with his National Socialist ethnic states. He even believes this international solidarity is a conspiracy to destroy Germany. A conspiracy created by the Jews.
Marxism represents a pure attempt by the Jew to eliminate the overwrought importance of the personality in all areas of human life and replace it with the number of the mass.
But the Jews, Hitler said, were not only behind Marxism, they were also behind global capitalism. Now, this might seem a bit weird, equating Jews with communism and also with capitalism. That conspiracy seems to be a bit too far-fetched, but it aligns with Hitler's idea of propaganda. It's not a good idea to have all of these different enemies. So, all enemies must be merged into one, remember? And it helps that anti-Semitism was not unique within Germany. You are all more than familiar with the hatred of the Jews. But where does it come from? And just how much did Hitler show within his book what he planned to do with them? Well, in European history, Jews were a minority that was singled out persistently. Some stereotypes about Jews are directly the result of discrimination. In medieval Europe, trades were organized into guilds. There were guilds for brewers or smithies, builders or blacksmiths, masons, carpenters and millers. But Jews were not allowed to be part of any guilds. In many places, they were not even allowed to farm. So they were forced into trades that were not protected by these guilds, or trades that Christians were not allowed or did not want to do. One such trade that Christians were not allowed to do was to charge interest on loans, for example. This was called usury. Christians believed that charging interest on a loan was a sin. Exodus 22:25 and Leviticus 25:35-37 both forbade charging interest to fellow believers in need. It was viewed as a matter of charity, not an opportunity to profit from someone else's misfortune. Further, medieval church scholars, most notably Thomas Aquinas, were heavily influenced by the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle had argued that money was merely a tool for exchange and should not create more money on its own. And because the Book of Deuteronomy allowed charging interest to, quote, foreigners, the Jewish communities in Europe were essentially pushed into the role of moneylenders. Foreigners in this context also meant those of differing religions. So thus Jews took up the moneylending trade. In Germany, Jews were also overrepresented in other non-traditional jobs, like newspapers. And with the rise of nationalism, Jews became singled out more and more as a group that doesn't seem to fit in. Controlling mass messages and money, both areas of great sensitivity that can easily stoke tensions. Anti-Semitism starts rising all over Europe, and in the late 1800s, there is a military scandal in France. A Jewish officer is convicted for spying, a crime he didn't commit. In a survey conducted at the time, it's established that half of the French population do not trust Jewish citizens. In 1905, Russia loses a war, and to divert anger, the Tsar turned to anti-Semitism. There were more than 700 pogroms in just 2 weeks. So Hitler's book stands in the long tradition of anti-Semitism. In 1919, Hitler writes for the first time that Jews are not a religion, but they are a race, and they must be forced out of Germany. Now, in Mein Kampf, he never writes he wants to kill the Jews. But language he does use make his intentions quite clear. Quote,
"The Jews are parasites, symbols of degeneration of the empire, or pathogens, a disease to be cured."
Talking about people like this dehumanizes them. When they're not seen as human, it makes them easier to get rid of. The first speech that Hitler gives when he gets out of prison makes this clear. He states that he is ready for a struggle against both Marxism and the Jew as a spiritual carrier of a world plague and epidemic. But in Mein Kampf, we can find a more chilling quote.
"If at the beginning of the war, 12 or 15,000 of these Hebraic corruptors of the people were held under poison, then the sacrifice of millions of the front would not have been in vain."
Reading this and knowing what will happen with millions of Jews gassed in Auschwitz and other places, it seems like Hitler is already here talking about his final solution for the Jews of Europe. After this, no one can doubt what Hitler's intentions were. But the transition from what is written in Mein Kampf to the mass extermination of the Jews is not a straight one. It is far more twisted. Jewish Germans were slowly excluded from society. They had to wear identifying markers because they did not resemble the propaganda which the Nazis broadcast. Like the propaganda picture of young Herbert and Helen Ava Levy, which were used in advertisements as two perfect Aryan children with blonde hair and blue eyes. Well, in actual fact, they turned out to be entirely Jewish. Why let facts get in the way of a good propaganda story, right? For a long time, Hitler and the Nazis had different ideas of what to do with the Jews. One of the options was to deport them to Siberia. But before that could happen, they had to conquer the biggest country in the world. On the 22nd of June, 1941, Hitler invades the Soviet Union. Hitler's whole ideology had led to this. A fight on an epic scale of life and death. Aryan Germans would crush the inferior Slav opponent. The army would penetrate deep into Soviet soil, but the advance soon ground to a halt. The obsession with the Soviet Union will be the end of Hitler. Like so many of his actions, Hitler had described the attack in his book. He also described how the attack could fail.
If one wanted land in Europe, this could, by and large, only be achieved at Russia's expense. For such a policy, however, there was only one ally in Europe, and that is England.
But why was Hitler so obsessed with land? Well, Hitler thinks that a great nation needs a lot of land to be able to feed its people. Now, in history, this was generally true, but by the 1800s, we saw many technical developments in farming. For example, artificial fertilizer improved yields, cooling kept food fresh, steamers made shipping go faster. But it doesn't matter. Hitler wants land, and he will get it, no matter what. But how? Should Germany pursue colonies? No, Hitler decides. Too expensive to maintain and too hard to defend. Plus, he doesn't want to compete with the British. Hitler likes the British. Instead, he needs the lands of the Soviet Union. The best thing is that he will kill two birds with one stone. As we've seen, according to Hitler, the Soviet Union is ruled by a Jewish conspiracy. Destroying the Soviet Union means destroying this conspiracy. He knows that Germany would lose this battle on its own, and he dreams of an alliance with the United Kingdom. But when he invades the Soviet Union in 1941, this hasn't happened. Great Britain are instead at war with Germany. But the ability of Hitler and Germany to even wage a world war in the first place was almost stopped by its economic circumstances. When Hitler was released from prison on the 20th of December 1924, just 8.5 months after he was initially imprisoned, he quickly compiles all of the pages he has written in prison to release his book. But is he too late? Germany is no longer a chaotic country from the times of the coup. The economy is stable. When the respected front-footed Zeitung reviews Hitler's book, they see the end of the Nazi movement. Quote,
"Constructive politicians have conquered the ghost of chaos. They have rebuilt Germany and are about to restore safety in Europe. The times have moved on. Hitler is based on this personal testimony. He is done."
Well, the voters seem to agree. In 1928, the Nazis got just 2.63% of the popular vote. But the words of the front-footed Zeitung would not last. Just a year later, a global financial crisis hits Germany, the second in 6 years. Germany is plunged into a deep depression. The appeal of the Nazis rises once again. Hitler and the Nazi Party are victims of circumstance. This is also reflected in the sales of his book. It now becomes a bestseller. And when Hitler comes to power in 1933, the sales of his book have made him so rich that he can refuse his government salary. An action purely for the people, of course. Hitler, now in power, quickly gets to work on the promises he has made in Mein Kampf. In his book, he said that when the Nazi Party would come to power, quote,
6 years would not have passed before a courageous Reich's foreign policy would find an equally bold will among a people thirsting for freedom.
Within 6 years, Hitler invades Poland. It is the start of the Second World War. But what does all of this mean for us now, in 2026? Well, it's 100 years since Hitler released Mein Kampf, yet we are still obsessed, as ever, with the Nazis. Since 1960, on average, Hitler or the Nazis are still mentioned at least once in, on average, 9% of all books published. Godwin's Law states that every discussion on the internet ends with the Nazis. In politics, comparing someone to Hitler is the ultimate insult. Let's look at outcomes. Exterminating the Jews. Starting a world war. Attacking its neighbors and trying to take over the world with an evil ideology. No one is as bad as Hitler, right? So should we be too quick to compare other people with him? Better yet, should we focus more on comparing his political approach in a democratic arena? Because whilst Hitler is long gone, his methods, politics, beliefs and behaviors are certainly not. Hitler was a populist. He knew that in times of uncertainty and economic hardship, the call for a strong leader becomes louder. There are others who understand that message too. Now, extreme right-wing nationalism is out in the open once again. In the United States, economic uncertainty has led to big promises from those in power.
Under my plan, incomes will skyrocket, inflation will vanish completely, jobs will come roaring back, and the middle class will prosper like never, ever before, and we're going to do it very rapidly.
All effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed in stereotyped formulas.
But no hope or dream we have for America can succeed unless we stop the illegal immigrant invasion, the worst that's ever been seen anywhere in the world.
These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forth.
And we know they come from prisons, we know they come from mental institutions, insane asylums, we know they're terrorists. Nobody has ever seen anything like we're witnessing right now. It is a very sad thing for our country. It's poisoning the blood of our country.
People do not perish from lost wars, Hitler said. Quote,
but from the loss of the power of resistance that only pure blood possesses.
It's poisoning the blood of our country.
With these words, he is trying to restrict free press. Trump hates free press. That way, people can say what they want about him, and he can't control it. Thus, he has asked generals to get ready for a war against the enemy within.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military. Ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, Chicago, they're very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one. And this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too. It's a war from within.
He sees the left as an enemy of stability in America. Even though the extreme right is responsible for 3/4 of all political violence over the last 2 decades. It's not hard to see the parallels to a people that saw difficult times, rising inequality and a change in society. Now, believe it or not, I'm not against Trump or the MAGA movement. I'm not supportive of them, but I'm certainly not against them. I'm not necessarily a liberal either. I'm not for or against any political party or movement. I've said this on the podcast before. Instead, I think the democratic establishment and system should be overhauled. I believe all politicians are self-serving career chasers, and I'm not convinced any are in their positions for the good of their country. Do I have opinions on how things should be done? How things should be run? Sure, of course. But I keep them to myself until a real leader comes along with solutions that benefit the majority, support the country, and are doing so for the right reasons. You should beware of politicians that offer easy solutions and lay all of the problems at the feet of one group of people and that disregard democratic institutions, a free press, and the rule of law, because we know what can happen. Dead Souls is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and Coag. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at Dead Soulscast and Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters and exclusive access to written articles, blogs, and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often our podcasts get age-restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm-friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered, and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research, and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. patreon.com/deadsouls. That's it. Thank you for listening. Good night, everyone.